You're listening to a resource from the Association of Certified Biblical Counselors, where we seek to promote excellence in biblical counseling. For more resources or to find out more information about ACBC, please visit us at biblicalcounseling.com.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Dan Dean, and I've been ACBC certified for about 5 years, and I'm an internal medicine doctor, and this meeting is entitled How to Help Elders or Pastors Think Through Medication Biblically. But you don't have to be an elder or pastor. You can be a regular person, too. So, all right. So I met some people that are actually here to try and find out information so they can share it with their elders and help them. So that's what we're here for. And so everybody needs to know this stuff, okay? Can you see this okay? Is it all right? I got my medical education in Washington, D.C. at George Washington University, and then I trained in internal medicine in Spokane, Washington, and I've been there for 31 years. And being a doctor is an amazing privilege because you get to be with people when they're suffering and they're afraid, and there's just an opportunity there to love on them during that time. So it's a wonderful privilege. So I've been married to Kelly. She's in the back row there. She's the cute one there. And we've been married for 31 years. We have 3 kids, 5 grandkids, 37 years. But it only feels like 31. Okay. Forget what you just heard. So she helped put me through medical school years ago, and then I kind of helped put her through getting her MABC down at Bob Jones. So, you know, when you're maybe over 50 and you're having to learn how to use Turabian and some different programs, it's a sanctifying moment for sure. So, and we're members at Faith Bible Church in Spokane. We've been there for nearly 30 years. And I'm one of the elders, and I'm in the counseling ministry, and so we get to work with our other counselors there, and we have had a training center there since 2008. So I've been certified for about 5 years, like I told you, and Kelly said, tell them some funny stories. So Randy Patton was my supervisor, and he's such an amazing guy, but he would say things like, okay, Dan, I want you to make a record of what you learned from me, and then write it down and then send it to me. It's called Lessons Learned. And so I sent it to him, and he said, you know, that was pretty good, but I think you could do better. And in my mind, I'm going, I'm a busy doctor. I don't have time for this. And so he sent it to me. He sent me somebody else's example, and it was better than mine. And so I changed it, and that was good for me. And then I'd be counseling some people, and he would say, you know, these cases are too easy for you. I want you to keep counseling them, but they're not going to count. So, if anybody here is in the process of wanting to get certified, don't give up. I mean, I've often said that the most angry time I've ever been was during my certification process. Anyway, don't give up. It's a sanctifying process for everybody. So I have a question for all of you. How many of you take over-the-counter medication? All right. And then how many of you take prescription medication? Okay, how many of you don't take any medication at all? Okay, now, you know pride is a sin. Okay, so just let go of that right now. Does anybody here know someone who takes a psychiatric medication? Okay. Well, in our counselor's coffee every Tuesday afternoon from about 4 to 5:30, we will share cases, and we'll be talking about a counselee, and we'll get to the part where the person says, and they're taking sertraline, and that's for their anxiety, and they're taking this for sleep at night. And I can look around the room at all the counselors, and I'll see them do this. And they're all thinking, what do I do with that information? They're on medication. What do I do with that? And they wonder, does the medication help or not? So I bet that's why you're here, right? So you've come across people and you've wondered, does this help? How can it help? How do I think about this? And what do I do with this information? So my goal today is that we're not really going to talk about blood pressure medication or cholesterol medication, but we are going to talk about psychotropic or psychiatric medication. First of all, I want to do a brief survey of what it says in the Bible about medication. And you know what? It talks about salves, ointments, and balms. And these had monetary value. They were given as gifts, and they had some medicinal value. And there are more actual references to these topical medications in the Old and New Testament than any other medical treatments, which I thought was interesting. I did not know that. Is there a negative to a salve or a balm? Well, Ecclesiastes 10:1 says not to let dead flies get into your ointment. Okay, so remember that. Then there's medications in the Bible, and alcohol is mentioned in several places, and it can be used for suffering. So there's passages where alcohol might be used in a palliative way for someone who's suffering. And also, of course, Paul told Timothy to use it for digestive purposes. So I would think that in some ways you could think of alcohol as a medication, or at least, if not a medication, at least a drug. Okay. Does it say anything about physicians in the Bible? Well, Jesus referred to physicians, and he always did in a good light, actually. So in Matthew 9:12, he says, those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. And then there was Dr. Luke, who was referred to as beloved in Colossians. And there is actually such a thing as a worthless physician. Job 13:4 says, as for you, you whitewashed with lies, worthless physicians are you all. Anybody ever met a worthless physician? They exist. They really do. So then there's examples where physicians don't always help. So there's the story of the woman with the 12-year flow of blood, and there's actually really two versions of that. There's the version where Luke describes it. Of course, he's a doctor being nice to other doctors, and he says, there was a woman who had a discharge of blood for 12 years, and though she had spent all her living on physicians, she could not be healed by anyone. So that's the gracious version. And then you go to Mark 5:26. This is the layman's account, which says, she had suffered much under many physicians and had spent all that she had and was no better, but rather grew worse. So in even these days, this happens to people. People suffer under physicians. People lose all their money. They don't always get better. So that's the reality. Then there's medical treatments in the Bible. And we have the Good Samaritan who teaches us about wound care, right? So he bound up the wounds with wine and oil. And then there's Hezekiah's boil, and Isaiah told him to make a poultice out of a cake of figs, which made me think, what about fruit cake? Could that have some medicinal purpose? So, anyway. Then there's sometimes medication for wrong motives. So there's a story of Asa's feet. And in the 39th year of his reign, Asa was diseased in his feet, and his disease became severe. Yet even in his disease, he did not seek the Lord, but sought help from physicians. So Asa had a medical problem, and he did not go to the Lord first about his illness, but put his hope in the physician. So we see that all the time in our world. People are, they're not going to go to the Lord. They're going to say, can a physician help me? Is there a medicine for me? Is there something like that? So that we see that all the time. Then in the Bible, we do hear something about spiritual sickness, and it often refers to people as being sick, but it's their spiritual condition that is sick. Jeremiah 30:13 says, there's none to uphold your cause, no medicine for your wound, no healing for you. Jeremiah 46:11 says, go up to Gilead and take balm, O virgin daughter of Egypt. In vain you have used many medicines, there is no healing for you. The Bible then prescribes spiritual balms and medications for spiritual illnesses. So what's the cure? The cure for spiritual sickness? Proverbs 17:22 says, a joyful heart is good medicine, but a crushed spirit dries up the bone. And Proverbs 3:5-8 says, trust in the Lord with all your heart. Do not lean on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make straight your paths. Be not wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and turn away from evil. It will be healing to your flesh and refreshment to your bones. Then in the New Testament, Jesus offers the ultimate spiritual healing in Revelation 3:18. He says, I counsel you to buy from me gold refined by fire, so that you may be rich, and white garments, so that you may clothe yourself, and the shame of your nakedness may not be seen, and salve to anoint your eyes, so that you may see. So you pastors and elders and counselors may not know what medication a person needs, but you know how to help someone to have a joyful heart and how to turn away from evil, right? So we can do that. Finally, there's spiritual surgery, and Hebrews 4:12 says, tells us how to do open heart surgery, for the word of God is living and active, sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing to the division of soul and of spirit, of joints and of marrow, and discerning the thoughts and intentions of the heart. It is God's word that cuts through to expose the heart condition. This is a spiritual scalpel that you, the counselor, can use to restore a sick heart. But here's the challenge. When you see a counselee that is on a psychiatric medication, he may or may not have a medical illness, but he may have a spiritual illness. So it's hard to discern that sometimes. And prescription medication may not be helpful in this case if it's a spiritual problem. Spiritual medicine is what we all need. So let's dive into the science of medicine and how doctors approach a problem. This is where I'm going to teach you how doctors think, because they do. Okay. So we're going to talk a little bit about the disease model of medicine. And for thousands of years, medicine was an art and it was a profession. As you know, two books of the New Testament were written by a physician, Dr. Luke, and I like to think he was probably an internist. So, but back then, medicine was really more of an art and a profession, but it wasn't really a science. So really the science of medicine started about 150 years ago, and here's what happened. There was a doctor named Paul Ehrlich who was a professor and a physician and a scientist in Germany, and he discovered that if he put certain types of stains on tissue samples, sliced them very thinly, and put them under the microscope, he could see different types of cells. This was something we now call the Gram stain. Anybody ever do the Gram stain when they were in biology class? Yes, so that's still, we still use that. So if he could identify normal tissue with these stains, he could also identify abnormal tissue. Because he could identify the normal tissue, he could then tell what was abnormal, and we call that pathology. So back then, all he had was his microscope and a Gram stain, but 100 years later, we have MRIs and CT scans and all kinds of lab tests and genetic testing, all kinds of things that we can use to try and figure out what's normal and what's abnormal, and it's quantifiable. So Dr. Ehrlich also invented the concept of chemotherapy, and back then he was trying to treat syphilis, and once he could see these little organisms under the microscope that were called spirochetes, then he would treat people with a chemical that was horrible, but theoretically was going to make them better, okay? So this is when chemotherapy was invented, and a lot of times when we hear chemotherapy now, we think, oh, that person's getting treated for cancer of some sort, but really any time you take a medication for anything, that is actually chemotherapy. Dr. Ehrlich also invented the concept of the magic bullet, and a magic bullet is like the perfect drug. So the goal is to come up with a medication that only kills the organism that's causing pathology and does not kill any normal cells in the human, okay? Or if you're treating cancer, a magic bullet would only kill the cancer cells and not all the normal cells in the patient's body. Well, I have news for you. There really is no magic bullet yet. So why does chemotherapy work against cancer? You might know this, but we'll just review it quickly. Cancer cells grow quickly in a patient's body, and chemotherapy is designed to kill rapidly dividing cells. The problem is that normal cells in a person's body also divide rapidly, some of them. So like the ones that make your hair, the ones that line your intestinal tract, the ones that make your bone marrow work and produce new red cells and white cells and platelets. And this is why you hear when somebody's getting chemotherapy, oh, their hair all fell out, or they're having stomach problems, or their counts are low, and it's because the chemotherapy is not a magic bullet. It's actually affecting some of their normal cells as well. So why is pathology important? the importance is we need to be able to tell if something is abnormal. And remember, you have to know what's normal first before you can tell if something is abnormal. And doctors have come up with all sorts of tests to define normal versus pathology. And we talked about that already, x-rays, biopsies. Sometimes people will say, I want you to give them a specimen of this. And they say, are you kidding me? You want some of that? And I say, yes, it's actually a legitimate test. So go collect that specimen. But the big principle for all of you is when you hear the word pathology, I want you to think disease. Okay? Pathology equals disease. Can you repeat after me? Pathology equals disease. Good. You're paying attention. Now, I want to talk about strep throat as an example. So, did you know that if your doctor does not treat your strep throat, it could be bad for you? So, you could get rheumatic fever, you could get heart valve disease, possibly even go into kidney failure. So, strep throat is a big deal, and lots of people get it every year. So, when the patient gets a sore throat, here's what you're thinking. I want it to stop, right? You don't really care if it's strep or what it is. You just want the doctor to make you well. Well, your doctor's not thinking that way. Your doctor is thinking, I need to make sure this person meets the criteria that I can treat them for strep throat. And those criteria are you have to have tonsillar exudates, history of fever, tender lymph nodes, and you can't have a cough. But you didn't know it was that complicated. Well, what is a tonsillar exudate? I'm going to show you, so I hope everybody have a good breakfast this morning. Okay, so if you have those pus pockets in your throat, I'm thinking tonsillar exudates, I might need to treat you with antibiotics. Now remember, strep throat is caused by a bacteria, and we use antibiotics for bacteria. Antibiotics don't work for viruses, and everybody knows about viruses now, don't we? Okay. So there are certain antiviral medications for certain viruses, but many sore throats are a virus that you can't actually treat. You just have to wait for the person to get better. So you have your sore throat, and your doctor is thinking, do they meet these three criteria? So if you don't have any of those three criteria, your doctor is going to say, I can't order a strep test on you. You should probably just take Tylenol, and I'm sorry, because you came wanting them to give you antibiotics probably. Okay, so here's what I tell people. If they have a virus and they have a sore throat, I say, if I give you antibiotics, you'll be well in 7 days. If I don't give you antibiotics, you'll be better in a week. Right? So antibiotics won't really help, but people think that that's what they need. So if you have met those three out of four criteria, then I actually have to do a test now to prove that you actually have strep throat. And there's a couple different kinds. So there's the rapid strep antigen, which takes an hour. There's the DNA probe testing, which takes 24 hours. And there's the throat culture, which takes 48 to 72 hours. Which would you like? The rapid, right? You want the rapid because you want to be better. So if you test positive, then I can prescribe an antibiotic for you. But I don't necessarily have a magic bullet. So if I can give you an antibiotic that has a 95%+ chance of curing you, that's pretty good. But the downside is there can be side effects. So anybody ever take an antibiotic and gave them a yeast infection or diarrhea or a rash? So even an antibiotic has its potential side effects we have to think about. What about treating cancer? Pathology is important with cancer also. And if my patient comes to me with 3 months of weight loss, night sweats, and fevers, and now they're starting to cough up blood, I want more information. So I order a chest x-ray, and here's what it looks like.
Now, can you guys see this big round thing right here? That's not normal. Okay. So when I see that, I need more information as the physician, okay?
I want to get a biopsy, and I want to look at it under the microscope to find out what that is. Now, here's some pathology slides for you. This is what normal lung tissue looks like under the microscope. And do you see all these white spots?
Those are the alveoli. That's just air. So that's where a normal lung looks like. And you want lots of air in your lungs, right? The pink spots are the places in between the air sacs where the blood vessels go, which take the oxygen in and out of your lungs. So that's a normal lung biopsy. Here's an abnormal one. Now, you don't see any air sacs here. It's just full of cancer cells. And
This patient has non-small cell adenocarcinoma of the lung. And once you know that, then there's very specific types of chemotherapy and treatments for that type of cancer. And so I want to send them to the oncologist so that they can get treated for that. And remember, chemotherapy is going to work by trying to kill the right cells and hopefully not the other cell. So when your doctor can find the pathology in your disease, remember pathology equals disease, she can prescribe the best treatments for improvement or cure. I love the far side. So the doctor says, I'm afraid you've got cows, Mr. Farnsworth. So now can you guys spot the pathology in this picture? Right. It is not normal to have cows growing out of your body. So you guys are doing great. You're halfway through medical school already. Okay? Now let's talk about disorder. So up until now we've been talking about disease. And any problem where you can find a quantifiable, a definable abnormality, that's a disease. But now we're going to talk about disorders. And I like to use an example with fibromyalgia. Anybody ever hear of that one? So that actually fits in the category of a disorder, not a disease. And you might know somebody with this disorder, or somebody here in this room might actually have that diagnosis. And I want to really be careful as I say this and clarify that the patient has definite symptoms, and the suffering and their devastation is real, but there's not an actual diagnostic test that I can use to test to see if they have fibromyalgia. So it fits in the category of a disorder. Now, fibromyalgia has a list of criteria that helps make the diagnosis, and the list is actually very detailed and specific, and once you get that diagnosis, there are a number of treatments that seem to help some people. But here's the challenge of anything that's a disorder. Some patients will take on the label of fibromyalgia and it becomes their identity. You might know somebody like that. Some of the medications and treatments seem to help for the patient, but many people have tried all the different treatments and still continue to suffer. And you might know somebody like that. They've tried everything and they're still suffering. So the patients get frustrated with their doctors because they want answers and they want help. And doctors get frustrated with the patients because the doctors have run out of answers and they also want to help. So everybody gets frustrated when there's a disorder. So we've talked about medical disease and we've also talked about medical disorders. But what about the science of psychiatry? And I want to remind you that psychiatrists actually went to medical school like me. And they also want to help their patients that come to them with emotional pain and suffering. And they may have been trained to look for pathology also. So you might ask, how does a psychiatrist look for pathology? What tests can a psychiatrist run on a patient? Well, there was a classic written in 1950 called Dr. Dan the Bandage Man. And I didn't read it when I was a kid, but in 2000, the 50-year anniversary, Golden Books people produced a whole bunch of them, and they come with a Band-Aid in the back. Aww. And so I have lots of patients bringing me copies of this. So this classic is still available if you want to read it. But in 1952, that was the first year that the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual was published, and that was called the DSM-1. And there have been several revisions since then. You've probably heard about them. And what may have started out as an effort to be scientific has become more political and cultural, I think. 2013, the DSM-5 was published, and it's considered the Bible of psychiatry. So let's talk about how a mental health practitioner might use this publication to help them. You know about the DSM-5, and the question is, how do you diagnose a major depressive disorder with the DSM-5. And I think I've got the big old fat list of all the criteria in your handout, so you don't have to write like crazy with this. But it's actually called depressive disorder. And it has lists of criteria, just like other disorders have. So I'm going to go down the list and you're going to go, wow, okay? You have to have five or more of the following symptoms, and they have to have been present during the same 2-week period, and they represent a change from previous functioning. So at least one of the symptoms is either depressed mood or loss of interest or pleasure. And do not include symptoms that are clearly attributable to another medical condition. For example, if you have hypothyroidism, you can't count that. Okay? So here's the list. Depressed mood most of the day, nearly every day, as indicated by either subjective report or observation made by others. Markedly diminished interest or pleasure in all or almost all activities most of the day, nearly every day. Significant weight loss when not dieting or weight gain or decrease or increase in appetite nearly every day. You've seen a pattern? Insomnia or hypersomnia nearly every day. Psychomotor agitation or retardation nearly every day. Fatigue or loss of energy nearly every day. Feelings of worthlessness or excessive or inappropriate guilt nearly every day. Diminished ability to think or concentrate or indecisiveness nearly every day. Recurrent thoughts of death, recurrent suicidal ideation with a specific plan, or a suicide attempt or a specific plan for committing suicide. So in conclusion, because psychiatrists use lists to define disorders, it seems like what I call squishy science. Okay? So lists of criteria make it seem more scientific, but was anything on that list very quantifiable? No, it isn't. It's very subjective. So there was no blood test that comes back positive or negative for depression. So the result is, remember what happens when people are diagnosed with a disorder? Frustration for the patient, frustration for the doctor. So many of the problems that psychiatrists are treating fit under the category of disorders, not diseases. Not all of them, but many. So that was how psychiatrists look at depression, but how does the biblical counselor look at depression? And I would love to spend time with you talking about how you can treat depression as a counselor. And I have a big list in the back of my favorite resources for that. And I would love to have you go and look at those because they're awesome if you're treating somebody with depression. Anybody ever counsel somebody with depression? Really hard. Really hard. So if I have somebody that has depression, I have to kind of say, it's probably going to be you. This is not going to be a quick one because it just takes a long time for people to get out of their depression, okay? And can you guys hear me back there? Okay, thanks. So now let's say your counselee is taking an antidepressant. How did we get all those antidepressant medications? We're going to talk about that a little bit now. In this section, I'm not talking about blood pressure medicine, diabetes medicine. We're just talking about psychiatric medications. And some people call them psychotropic medications, which is the same thing, okay? So one of the questions I have is there a magic bullet for depression? And I would say the pharmaceutical industry has been looking for one for 50 years, and they will tell you that your problem is you have a chemical imbalance. Have you ever heard that theory? Okay. How did they get that idea? Well, here's how it starts. Pharmaceutical companies are operating on the assumption that you have a chemical imbalance in your brain. It might be serotonin, it might be norepinephrine, it might be dopamine, but they cannot actually poke a needle into your brain and measure the levels, okay? And actually, if you were to go to your doctor and say, can you check my serotonin levels, they cannot order a test for that, okay? So I think that's kind of interesting. So they're making assumptions based on what's happening inside the person's brain. Now, we all know about synapses, right? So I'm going to show you a really cool diagram in just a minute. But serotonin is produced at a nerve ending, and it sends a message to another nerve in the synapse. Norepinephrine is also produced at the synapse and communicates to the next nerve. So here's my cool diagram.
So if you think of a synapse, this is one nerve here, and here's the other nerve, and this little space right in between the synapse. And a message is coming from this nerve, and it releases chemicals into that space, and those chemicals then go to the next nerve and continue to send that electrical impulse. And that's what's happening here. So here's the nerve that's releasing serotonin into that nerve space, into that synapse, And then the serotonin attaches to these little receptors here, and zing, the electrical current keeps going. The theory is that there's not enough serotonin in this area, which is why the person is depressed. So most of the medications are trying to make the serotonin level higher in that synapse to help people function better. Okay? Memorize it. It'll be on the exam. Okay?
Right. You don't really need to take a picture. Just memorize it. You know. Okay. Most antidepressant medications are trying to change the levels of serotonin and norepinephrine in the synapses of the brain. And how do they decide if the medication works? Well, they do research on live human beings that have been diagnosed with the disorder depression. So imagine you're a pharmaceutical company and you have a new medication that you hope will be helpful. You also hope it will make you a lot of money. Okay? You ask people who are depressed to sign up to be in your study, and you make sure they meet the criteria of depression as outlined in the DSM-5. Then you tell them about your medication, and you tell them you will either give them your new medication or something called a placebo. These patients understand that they might not get the active drug, but they say they want to participate anyway because they're helping science. So what is a placebo? Here's my definition. It's a pill that looks like your study drug, but only contains inert ingredients. It might be sucrose or sugar or starch of some sort. It doesn't really have any medication in it. Now, in the study, 50% of the patients get the new drug, but they're not sure they're getting the new drug. And 50% of the people get the placebo, but they're not sure what they're getting there either. So then the researchers study the results and watch for side effects, and they watch to see if there's any benefit. Okay? And the FDA wants to know more about this. Everybody knows about the FDA now, right? So I think the FDA really does want to help people. So what is the placebo effect? Well, the patient has improvement in symptoms without getting any active ingredient. Many placebos help the patient 25 to 30% of the time. And so the question is, why do people get better when given a placebo? And the answer is hope. Hope is huge. Hope is huge. So when your child asks you to kiss their owl, and you kiss it with that filthy mouth, all those bacteria and viruses, why do they get better? It's because of the placebo effect, because they have hope, right? So you're the pharmaceutical company. You hope your drug is the new magic bullet for depression, and the FDA requires that your drug work better than placebo. It's got to be at least better than placebo, okay? Your drug must be safe and not harmful, and a cure would be even better if you had that. So my wife, Kelly, she's in the back row there, and whenever I start to talk quietly, she goes, yeah. She likes to listen to those pharmaceutical advertisements where they say, this drug is thought to help in this way. Or this drug might be useful in this way. It's very vague. Have you ever noticed that? And then they list all the side effects at the end really fast. She just likes to listen to that because pharmaceutical companies have to tell you all that stuff. And there you go. So how many medications are there out there for depression? I gave you a list. And there's a handout. And here's the list. I kind of crammed it all into one thing just to show you. But there are a lot of medications just for depression. And in your handout, I also have medications for anxiety, for schizophrenia, for bipolar, for insomnia. They're all in there for you if you want to refer to those in the future if one of your counselors has that. But I want to show you a little bit about how this works. So
if you see up here, the very first category is SSRIs, and there's a bunch of them there. And the first drug there is citalopram. And that means it does work for depression, because this is the depression slide. But it also has an A after it, and it has an OCD after it, which means sometimes a doctor is going to use it for anxiety, or they might use it for OCD. So the cool thing is, if your counselee is telling you, I'm on sertraline, or I'm on citalopram, you go, well, what is citalopram? You can Google it, and it'll tell you, oh, it's called Celexa. So then you can say, I wonder what they're using it for. Well, their doctor might be giving it to them for depression or anxiety or for OCD, which might be of interest to you. So there you go. You can use that if you like.
So the question is, do the pills work? And internal medicine doctors have been prescribing these medicines for years, and they ask themselves the same question. So a couple years ago, the Annals of Internal Medicine published a study where they did something called a meta-analysis. And that's where you take a whole bunch of studies and put them all together and try to figure out if there's any benefit. So they compiled the results of many studies to try to see if there was actual scientific proof that these medications are helpful for our patients. And here's what they studied. This was back in 2016, and they looked at medication for depression, counseling for depression, and they call that CBT, which I don't want to confuse with CBD, which I think some people are using for depression also. Then there was complementary therapies like acupuncture, meditation, omega-3 fatty acids, SAMe, St. John's wort, and yoga. And then they also just used exercise. And they looked at all those things to try and figure out where there was harm and where there was benefit. So the results are the benefit of antidepressants and cognitive behavioral therapy were similar, and they were considered viable choices for initial treatment. So if I have a depressed patient in my office, I could say, you could try CBT or counseling, or you could try medication. They both work about the same. There was no statistically significant differences in antidepressants and other treatments. That means antidepressants did not work better than those other therapies. That means people have some options. And here's the important difference. Antidepressants have side effects. And so many times a person's going to have side effects from their medication that might be harmful for them. Now, if I was to do yoga, I would probably get hurt. So I'm not very flexible. So there are side effects to yoga, so watch out. So more results. Only 60% of patients treated with antidepressants respond, which means 40% do not. Only 30% are cured or achieve remission, and that means 70% are not. And antidepressants and aerobic exercise had similar results. So very interesting. Now, if you added counseling to an antidepressant, it did not necessarily make them better than if they just did one or the other. So if you're talking to somebody who's thinking about going on medication, you could actually say science proves that counseling works as well as medication. And that would be true. Also proves that exercise can be just as well as helpful as medication. So that's kind of cool. So if the evidence, because you're thinking, okay, so why are all these people on medication? And I'm going to tell you. If the evidence seems so marginal, why do doctors prescribe antidepressants? They know it's squishy science, but they want to relieve suffering, which is huge. Doctors really do want to help people, and they see a lot of suffering. So the other thing is that many people would rather take a pill than go to counseling. If you go to counseling, there's a copay every time. You have to take time off from work. You have to get babysitting. You have all these things. So it's much more convenient to take a pill than it is to go to counseling. So counseling is more expensive than the pill. And medications, I will say, I believe this to be true. Medications do seem to help stabilize some people when they're in a crisis. So doctors see people that are in crisis all the time, and those medications do seem to help often. So doctors see lots of suffering, and like I said, they want to help. Now, although most psychiatrists really care about their patients and want to help them with medications, they cannot claim to be scientific like the other fields of medicine. Some very reputable leaders in the field of psychiatry have said things like this. Here we go. DSM diagnoses are not useful for research because of their lack of validity. DSM diagnoses have given researchers a common nomenclature, but probably the wrong one. And that was a lady named Nancy Andreessen, who was a former editor of the American Journal of Psychiatry. Here's another one. In truth, the chemical imbalance has always been a kind of urban legend, never a theory seriously propounded by well-informed psychiatrists. That's Ronald Pies, editor of the Psychiatric Times in 2011. So if you guys got this essay, there's a lot of really helpful information here about the history of medications. The very first article is by a guy named Whitaker, who's actually not a Christian. He's a journalist and has studied this whole thing for years. And then there's a variety of opinions, even in ACBC. You won't see complete agreement about what to do with medication. So those of us who are medical physicians see some benefit to medication. Dr. Berger, who is a wonderful, sweet man, feels very strongly that all medications are not helpful, and he's got some stuff in there too. So you'll get smarter when you read this for sure. It may not totally clear things up for you. So how should we think about somebody who's taking a psychiatric medication? Well, here's what I want you to think. So they're sitting across the table from you. They just told you they're on medication. You're tempted to go,
don't do it. Okay.
Their doctor probably meant well by prescribing it. Okay. So doctors don't wake up in the morning and say, who can I screw up today? Okay. You might ask them if their doctor did any tests to look for pathology. Did you get a physical exam? Did you have any lab tests? Because sometimes people don't even get that done before they get started on medication. They may actually have true depression, and they've already gotten some benefit from the medication. That's also possible. It's very important that it's not your job to tell them to stop the medication. Is that hard for any of you? Good. Yeah. You're not their doctor, right? You can't tell them to stop the medication. I can tell my patients to stop the medication, but I shouldn't even tell somebody else's patient to stop the medication because I'm not their doctor, okay? So, because you may not know the best way to taper off, and you didn't prescribe. So that's actually between the counselee and their doctor, and you don't have to worry about that. You don't have to go there. You've got plenty to do just with their counseling. So you can also ask them if they've tried counseling. Well, probably they're trying it right now when they're sitting across the table from you, right? And you can tell them that science shows that counseling works as well as medication, and that might give them some hope. Now, in biblical counseling, we love talking about putting off and putting on. And if you guys memorize that passage, Ephesians 4, 22 through 24, and then it's in Colossians 3, 5 through 17. And we love putting off and putting on, and we love giving that as homework for our counselees. Well, I have, those are Paul. He was an apostle. I have Dr. Dan's put-offs and put-ons. Okay, so here you go. Probably not as helpful, but it might help you. So here's my put-offs. Don't judge them if they're on medication. I like to say, don't be judgy. And we do that a lot in Christian culture, don't we? Don't make them feel like they have an inferior faith if they're on medication. Okay? Don't tell them that it's a sin to be on medication. Okay? That's the big take-home message right now. This is often the message that people get when they're on medication. They feel inferior. They feel like their faith is not adequate. They feel like they may be in sin, and you don't want to be that person that does that. So here's the put on. Ask what was going on at the time they started meds and what they were hoping the meds would do. You want to know that. What were you thinking this was going to do? What did you think it would help? And, of course, that's also called gaining involvement, isn't it? So ask them a whole bunch of questions. Ask why their doctor prescribed this medication, and were there other medications that they've tried first? That'll be helpful. Ask about side effects of the medication. Ask how well the medication has worked for them. Ask if you can go with them to the next doctor's appointment. Ask if you can have permission to speak with their doctor. You'll need a signed release, of course. And then get to work talking about the heart issues. Okay? That's what you're here for. I have some more thoughts. Taking medication is more, I think, of a Christian liberty issue, and we don't have to be divided about medication. So sometimes people are having so much trouble thinking clearly that medication is helpful so that they can get more sleep and start to focus. So have you ever tried to counsel somebody whose brain was just all over the place? You're giving them truth, and it does not stick because they might need to be on medicine for a while, okay? So it's very important that we're merciful. We want to be merciful. Now, I want to talk briefly about some other psychiatric diagnoses, and these are my opinions. They're not even necessarily ACBC, although I'd say they're pretty much ACBC, but even in our world, there is a spectrum of what people think. Schizophrenia. So I've taught you to think about pathology and disease, and I'm going to say that there seems to be some type of pathology here, but it's very tricky to figure out what it is. We've learned a lot about brain science, and there's all kinds of fancy scanners that'll tell us what's going on in the brain, but it's not, it's pretty squishy also right now. So a lot of people have hope in that. But there seems to be some pathology there. So these patients or counselees often do better on meds for life. And I think you should consider this as a disease and not a disorder. And you might wonder why. When psychiatrists do studies on people with depression, they use depression scales, which are very subjective. Okay, so rate how depressed you are today on a scale of 7 to 10, or 1 to 10. I feel 7 out of 10 today. I can't quantify that. That's totally what you're feeling, right? And so we can use those things for depression or other, or anxiety or those sorts of things. But when you have a person that is wigging out and harmful to themselves and to others, that's pretty quantifiable, actually. And when you give these people medication, they often settle down and they do better. And so I think there is a pathology there, and that's going to be a challenge with your counselees, because usually when they're on medication, they just don't feel as good. They feel a little dull, and they're always wanting to get off that medication. And many times, as you're counseling them in how to be more godly and how to please God in their life, you're going to want to say, okay, if you take your medicine, then you get to keep your job, and you get to keep your insurance, and that means you get to keep your family and stay in a home and a whole bunch of other things that are part of being a godly person. So those will be things that you don't necessarily need to counsel them to get off that medication. Bipolar 1. So there's two types of bipolar. There's bipolar 1 and bipolar 2. And I think bipolar 1 is also more of a disease. The criteria that they use are more stringent. Those are people that are actually getting manic. And they may also need medication for life. So when they're manic, they spend thousands of dollars. They become sexually promiscuous, delusional, violent. They ruin relationships, and they may end up in the hospital or in jail. And because the criteria used for bipolar 1 are a little more rigorous, these people do seem to do better on medication. I like to usually have them see a psychiatrist to prescribe those medications because they're a little more specialized. So if I have a patient with bipolar 1, I want them to have that psychiatrist to help me in that case. And same with like schizophrenia, they're going to want to get off their medicine. They always want to get off their medicine, and you might be counseling them, no, just stay on your medicine. If your doctor wants you to stay on your medicine, stay on that. Let's talk about your issues. Okay? Now, bipolar 2, here the criteria are more squishy, and many of these people get a label that I don't think helps them. So if you look at the criteria, and I'm not going to go through them right now, they don't get manic. They get hypomanic, or they get somewhat depressed. And there's a lot of people that are running around saying, I have bipolar, and really they have bipolar 2. And because that's a disorder, they've tried a bunch of medications, and they're frustrated with their doctor, and their doctor's frustrated with them too. And you might see that, okay? And you might not be able to get them to say, oh, yeah, I was diagnosed with bipolar 2. But if they're not having manic episodes, that may be what they have. Okay, anxiety. I'm going fast. So often here, the heart issue is fear or a desire for control. Now, we're biblical counselors, so we know how to deal with heart issues of anxiety. So one of the things that my wife Kelly and I love to use when we're helping people with anxiety is something by Jim Berg called Taking Time to Quiet a Noisy Soul. And that is a wonderful program that we highly recommend. And it helps people to work on basically a heart of unbelief. It takes 24 weeks to go through it. It's pretty intensive. It requires a lot of work, but it's really cool how it works for people. Now, people that have anxiety sometimes are on medicine for anxiety, and they're in that list that I gave you, but it's a category called benzodiazepine. And benzodiazepines are medicines that you can get addicted to. So you may have heard of Xanax or Ativan or Valium. Those really make people feel good. But when you try to get off of them, guess what the main side effect is? Anxiety. So you might have a counselee that really is doing much better, and you're working with their doctor, and you're saying, okay, let's see if we can wean you off this medicine. As they wean off, they're going to have symptoms of anxiety. You're going to want to be right there to help them with that process as they get off the medication. ADHD is also controversial, both in the secular and in the biblical counseling world. And these children and adults do seem to learn differently. Their brains seem to mature more slowly, and they don't do as well in a traditional educational model. And medications can be helpful, but there also is a potential for abuse of those medications. So there's probably many kids that have been over-medicated over the years with these medications as well. So, again, I put this in more of a Christian liberty area where I would say you don't need to judge them or their parents. They're suffering, and their parents are just trying to get their kid through school, and they're just reaching out for anything that they can find. So I would empathize and pray for them, okay? PTSD, this is also a real condition that results from a traumatic event. Medications for sleep can be helpful, and some people might need that for life. The VA medical system has been treating this for years, but we do have a lot of resources in biblical counseling now. A few years ago, there was a colloquium about that as well. So if you want to look at some of the other essays that talk about PTSD, that's available to you. Obsessive compulsive disorder. That's a real condition with some very disruptive obsessions and compulsions, and medications may be needed for life. The condition may not be curable, but people can be taught to control their thoughts and get their lives back. We help people in biblical counseling to control their thoughts all the time. So you can work with them to work on how they're thinking. Okay, so last but not least, what about biblical counseling? So every person with one of these diagnoses that I talked about actually has a sinful heart, and they need help to think and live biblically in the light of God's purpose for them. So you've got plenty to do without having to worry about their medication, right? So I always say to my patients, medications don't solve your problem. Medications may make you feel better about your problem, but counseling, especially biblical counseling, brings heart change and hope for resolution. I'd like to say God changes people, not psychiatric medication. Okay. So remember, it's very important to give hope. You can focus on their heart condition and let the doctor focus on the medication. Now, here's the final exam. Who prefers SA? You're getting nervous right now, aren't you? Anxiety. I've got a medicine for that. Who prefers multiple guests? Don't worry. The exam is actually for me, okay? So here's how I know if I pass. I pass if you understand that you don't need to judge people about their medication. I pass if you don't make people feel like they're a sinner for taking medication. But I fail if someone in this room is taking medication and you leave this room thinking that I told you to stop taking the medication. Okay? I fail. Yeah, that's what I do. I fail. So, my goal is that you understand better how to think about medications, and I want you to go with mercy and just love on these people that are taking medication and help them to work on their heart issue. So I got some time for questions. People always have lots of questions, so we'll go right till 10, and after that I'll release you if you want to go to the next session, but I'll stay here for a little bit longer if you need to. Yes, sir. So, give me the example. They're on medication?
Yeah, I'm on medication for depression, anxiety, and
right.
I'm just asking for your opinion as a counselor.
What would you do? Probably the first thing would be, what does your doctor think? And I would ask them, does your doctor think you're ready to go off the medication? And people always want to go off the medication. So that's pretty common. And I've had people a lot of times where I've had them on a medicine for depression, and it's been a year, and they're going, I want to get off this medicine. I said, well, did you work on your issues? And they go, no. I still want to get off the medicine. Okay, they go off the medicine. A month later, they're calling me because they never actually worked on their issue. So this would be an opportunity to say, does your doctor think you could? Would your doctor be interested in helping you to wean off the medication? And you could also say, is it okay if I talk with your doctor? Now, most doctors are so overwhelmed just with all the suffering they see every day, they go, I don't have time to counsel you. So if you have a counselor, great, I love that person. Go talk to them. Okay, so now your counselor might not want you talking to their doctor, but you can offer to say, hey, I've been working with so-and-so for a while. They want to get off their medication. What do you think about that? And they might say, well, what do you think about that? And you'd say, well, I'm not sure yet. I need to meet with them a little bit while longer. But, of course, you're going to work on their heart issues and figure out really where they are. How's that for a non-answer? Okay, anybody else? Yes.
How does biblical counseling work with your patients in the medical field?
How does it work?
Like, I guess, in your practice.
Right. So, it can be tricky, so I don't offer biblical counseling to all my patients, but I definitely do to some of them, or I'll suggest, hey, our website has a place and you can go there and fill out the PDI if you're interested. And I'll often ask them, are you meeting with your pastor or what's going on with that? So, I work in a Catholic healthcare industry where I can still talk about God. So that's kind of nice for me. So I can ask people where that's like. So sometimes I like to give them, you know, that little thing by Jerry Bridges, or just a little book about you can trust God. I love handing that out to patients when they're in distress. So I can do that. Anybody else?
And
Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. So I had one guy who was depressed and anxious, and he didn't go to our church, but I got him plugged in with our counseling pastor at our church, and pretty soon he was saying, can I get off the medication? And a year later I said, so are you doing counseling anymore? He said, yeah. I said, well, who are you meeting with? He said, well, it's Pastor Dan. Every morning on Sunday, I sit right in the middle of about 3 rows. And so he would be a great success story as far as getting to help with the mission. Yes.
This might be putting you on the spot. Forgive me if it is. Could you say something, if you're able, about this Greek word in the New Testament, pharmakeia, shows up 3 times, translated in English, witchcraft or sorcery, but its meaning is the use of a mind-altering drug. And in the context, it would have been used sort of, I think the closest thing picture we may have in our head would be more of a Native American using different kinds of drugs to try to connect with spirits and God and stuff. So in our present day context, how would you respond with that? Because it seems to be a biblical forbidding of mind altering drugs.
Yes. That's a good one. So, if pharmakeia is a hallucinogen or something somebody's using to detach from reality, I would say that's going to be a sin issue. And, we've had alcohol for years, which is a drug that many people use for that. And yet our Bible doesn't say that alcohol itself is a sin, but drunkenness is. And so that's an area that's really tricky. Now we have the whole marijuana CBD thing going on where it's, people think, well, just because it's legal, I'm not breaking Romans 13 anymore. I'm not going against my government. But marijuana makes you stupid, and it doesn't really help people in most cases. So there's a great book by a couple of pastors that is called Can I Smoke Pot? That is a really helpful one where you can kind of go through the heart issues, because most of the time, most people are using marijuana for intoxication just like they use alcohol, and I would put that in the sin category.
What would you say to a patient that came back and said, my antidepressant messed with my brain, or my antipsychotic hurt my brain?
I don't think you have to argue with that. So you could say, does your doctor want you to try something else? And you could find out where they are on that. But yeah, some people have tried medications and they haven't worked, and they've tried a number of medicines and they haven't worked, which is, that's okay, because medication really isn't going to fix their heart issue anyway. It's only going to treat some symptoms. So, yes. We can talk more if you want to afterwards. Okay.
So what one of the schizophrenic situation, Gail, that we could not do counseling unless she was on her medication. Mm-hmm. So she needed a drug to bring her back to reality to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so the challenge becomes, okay, if she thinks that it really the work of the spirit, or by me taking drugs now so I can function normally, it's actually the catalyst in helping me get back to reality and stay that way and live a life of good habits. And then the whole piece is, you know, kind of expect to ever get off of this thing. So as part of this kind of working through that, have you come across that situation?
Yes. So I think that is tricky because, again, the medicine is really not going to change their heart issues. And just about everybody that has schizophrenia also has sin and idols and other things that need to be dealt with. And so the medication could make them more clear so that they can actually do their homework and read their Bible and focus and let heart change come. So I don't necessarily see it as a supplement, but it definitely does help them get more out of their counseling.
So, putting the class of the disease,
right,
in a sense, should we kind of approach it as if, for example, my eyesight's really bad?
Yes.
For me to read God's word, I need to have glasses. So do we kind of feel like ignore this? This is actually helping you to be able to live as a creature, you know, trying to live a life of holiness. Should we approach it that way?
I like that. I mean, I think that's that could be helpful. So again, they're gonna want to focus on my side effects. I don't want to be on this medicine. I want to get off this medicine. And I think you definitely can say, we should work on your heart issues. And if you're doing really well, then maybe we can talk with your psychiatrist or your doctor about whether we can wean you down after a while and find out how it works. I think it's super humbling if you're a person that has found that they just seem to need medicine all the time. It makes them feel bad or like I'm a sinner or I'm an inferior Christian or those sorts of things. So that's something you're going to want to shepherd them through for sure. So, yes, sir.
So is this resource you mentioned here, Comparative Benefits and Harms, etc.,
I didn't write it. That's the one that I was referring to, though. This is where
is
all
it the white
No.
The meta-analysis?
Yeah, that's the meta-analysis.
Can you speak to ECT?
Yeah. ECT is where it's called electroconvulsive therapy. So there are some people that are so depressed and they've been on every medication and they're not seeming to get better. And for many years now, doctors have said, well, let's just induce a seizure in a person. And they hook up these electrodes to your brain and the anesthesiologist puts you to sleep and puts you in your mouth so you can't bite your tongue and then they zap your brain. And afterwards, you're kind of out of it for half a day or so. And for some people, that even seems to work for the depression. It sounds horrible. You know, it's what people do when they run out of options. That's the way this will not function. I've seen it done. I've read it. I mean, a lot of medication.
As a biblical counselor, I guess, like, I've laid people as biblical counselors, would you ever refer a patient back to their, like, psychiatrist and be like, okay, like, this may be something that, like, I can't deal with right now, and then you probably go and talk to, like, your psychiatrist or your doctor, maybe get medicated and then come back, or, I guess, the referring out kind of thing? What are your thoughts on that?
My experience is that most psychiatrists actually don't do counseling anymore. All they do is medication, so... If you had a person that's not doing well, I would probably say you should ask your doctor what they want to do. And their doctor might say, I'd like you to see a psychiatrist because I think you have bipolar 1 and you need to be on some of these heavy duty medicines. But you can still counsel them right there with a heart issue.
Right.
Does that help?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
Do you recommend the use of
what?
The testing left for shocking the brain.
I've never actually recommended it. I've had some people that their psychiatrist recommended it for them.
Okay.
And it might have helped. It might have sort of calmed them down a little bit. But sometimes you see people that are on a lot of medicines and they kind of look like zombies. You know, they're on so many medicines. And here's the thing. Psychiatrists see people that are really on the edge. And they are... They're like this close to being on the street. And they have a medication they think might help to calm them down and they'll be able to still keep a job. They might be walking around like a zombie, but they're not in jail. And to them, that's helpful. And so sometimes people end up being on 4 or 5 different medicines and there's a whole bunch of side effects and it's hard to know even how do we peel away from those medications in a way that's safe for them. So
that definitely does happen in this world. People are over-medicated, for sure.
Yes, sir.
Is there any research about hereditary effect? If there is such a thing? You inherited from your ancestors? Or like in our family, yeah. We have two sons that have both on medication for a long time.
Yeah. There's lots of research about that, and people love to study twins, you know, to see if there's two twins and one gets it and one doesn't. But it's hard to know a lot of times if somebody is in a family where there's lots of depression. Is it a gene or is it a learned behavior? So if you grew up in a home with a depressed person, you might become depressed as well. So that's a difficult part to do that. People think that schizophrenia does run in families, bipolar runs in families to some extent, so there might be a genetic component there.
Sure. Yeah. I understood you right, if it's a disorder, yeah. Something you can't scientifically say there's actually an issue here. And you said that study kind of said that it's similar to the effects of exercise. And the placebo effect is pretty strong. What are these medications doing? I'm talking about the lighter areas, for the disorder areas. Mm-hmm. It's just saying I feel better because I do it, because we all know exercise can be like a drug for people. Yeah. If they don't do it, they feel depressed that day.
Yeah.
They didn't get their workout in.
Yeah.
What's the difference in the two? And I'm not asking you for exactly, but that's what I'm hearing you say.
That's the tricky part, because if 30% of the time a placebo is going to make you better and I give you a medication and I say this will probably make you better, is it that it actually is helping you, or is it just a placebo effect? And that's hard to know, for sure. So, if it's a disorder, it's probably not going to be as dangerous for the person that, with help from their doctor to get off the medication too.
So follow up to that would be, yeah. If I'm giving a person a medication, and that medication makes them feel better.
Yes.
Does it actually fix a problem?
Right.
It makes them kind of feel better.
Yeah.
I'm getting help with my problem.
Yep.
But the real problem is still there.
Yeah. You should judge them a lot.
No.
And then work on that problem.
No, I've got a daughter, please. I know what I'm talking about.
Okay.
What I'm saying is, aren't we just masking over the issue? Because the issue's still there.
Right. Okay, so that's a very good question, because most people, when they are depressed, it's actually because they have sorrow over something. And God uses sorrow to draw us to Him. So your question is super important. Does this medicine make me just numb so I'm not drawn to the Lord?
Yeah, that's exactly my question.
Yeah, that's a good question. I love that question.
And you don't have an answer.
Wisdom. You're going to need wisdom.
Exactly.
That's awesome.
And I would never judge anybody on medication. I never have.
Yeah.
But I know that's a possibility from what you just explained.
Yeah, exactly. You're right. So, good. All right. You can be dismissed. I know you want to make it to the plenary, but thank you very much. I'll be here for a couple more minutes if anybody wants to ask other questions.
You're listening to a resource from the Association of Certified Biblical Counselors, where we seek to promote excellence in biblical counseling. For more resources or to find out more information about ACBC, please visit us at biblicalcounseling.com.